This is the 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
This is the 10th Voice. It is Kansas City's LGBT public affairs show. I'm your host today, Elizabeth Anderson, because it is the fifth Saturday of the month. You never know what you're going to get on the fifth Saturday of a month. Today, it's very exciting because it's a bonus book club of the Santa Moran Radio Book Club. We are going to have on the show Anne McMahon talking about her novel Goldenrod with Laura Nastro and Michelle Pond. And want to mention at the top of the show that Goldenrod is published by Bywater Books. And disclaimer, I am an editor for Bywater Books. We, in the next few months, are going to have quite a lineup. We're going to have Lee Lynch. I will be in Provincetown during the show, so we're going to tape that show ahead of time. We're doing An American Queer, The Amazon Trail. And then in November, we're doing Sandra Moran's posthumously published book, State of Grace, set in Kansas. And for that show, we're going to have Lori Moran, Cheryl Pletcher, and Anne Moore. And then in December, we are going to do Ann Aptaker's Cantor Gold series. That series is Criminal Gold, Tarnished Gold, and Genuine Gold. That will be exciting. A little different for the holiday season. We wanted something that was not quite so heartwarming and was more exciting. And then in January, we are going to do Karen Callmaker's Watermark. Karen will be participating in that show. Ann Aptaker will be participating in December. So we've got quite a lineup coming. I'm going to talk to Michelle and ask the first question. Then I'll ask Anne and Laura Nastro when we get them on the line. Michelle, what have you been reading recently that is not Goldenrod? It can be in the last few months, but what genres, when you just need a break and you think, oh, I have to read something like this, what is it?
For me, it's mystery, and it always has been, and always will be.
I've been rereading some Ellen Hart books. You did one of hers in June, and I found an older one that I hadn't read yet. And also, I did read Tarnished Gold, which is one of Ann Aptaker's books. I think that might be all in the mysteries in the past couple of months.
I will answer it while we're waiting for Ann and Laura to get on the line. I went through my bookcases and thought, here's a book that was recommended to me, and I haven't read it yet. It's been months. And so I read a book by a gay man called Treehab, Bob Smith. He's a stand-up comedian. He was the first out gay comedian on The Tonight Show. He was writing about being a, quote, nature boy, unquote. It was his time in Alaska and his love of nature, and I love nature. I just found it, his essays, wonderful. And he has had ALS, Lou Gehrig's, for the last 10 years, and I would recommend Treehab. Mysteries, especially British cozies, are something that I really enjoy.
And I read an Anne Roberts book for the first time. I met her at the Golden Crown Literary Society in Chicago in July. I heard her read it from the book, and she had mentioned that it was like two mysteries in one, and it was actually almost three. There was a third event that hadn't been solved. So I really enjoyed that.
An author that I have not met, but I've heard a lot about, is Jill McKnight. And just as I thought I didn't enjoy vampires until I read The Gilda Stories by Jill Gomez, I thought I wasn't that wild about werewolves until I read her books. Very, very interesting. And I'm currently reading a book by Penny Mickleberry, who is at Golden Crown.
Oh, so, yes.
And I think we have our guest.
You do?
Yes.
Anne, welcome to the show. We're talking about Goldenrod with author Anne McMahon, and we have been joined by Laura Nastro, also on the East Coast. And I will ask you the question that we were just talking about. Laura, I'll start with you. What genre do you like to read, and what have you been reading recently? What is your go-to?
I actually like to read mostly lesbian romances and probably nonfiction as kind of a fallback. I unfortunately have not been doing a lot of reading lately. There's been a lot going on in my life, and things have been very fractured and busy. So I've been reading a lot of magazine articles and newspaper articles and just bouncing from place to place. Thankfully, I had the time this week to sit down and reread Goldenrod, which was as pleasurable as it was the first time.
Well, let's talk to the author, Anne McMahon.
Yes.
What do you like to read?
When I actually can make time to read. The book that I read most recently, which I highly recommend, is a novel by a British author named Claire Fuller called Swimming Lesson. Very interesting and very worthwhile. It's probably just general fiction. And that's mostly what I read when I have a chance. My favorite time of the year is when we take our vacation and spend a few weeks up in Vermont on Lake Champlain, and I'll literally just load a bag up with books and drag them down by the water and start tearing through them.
Yeah, I saw photos of that, the Adirondack chair that you tend to plant yourself in.
Mine was the one with all the empty vodka bottles around it.
Well, let me ask you this, since you brought up Vermont, is that also where you do your writing?
I do a fair, in case the IRS is listening, I do a lot of writing in Vermont. In fact, I'm now working on a new book that is set in Vermont, kind of in the same way Backcast was set in Vermont. So since Vermont has become the home of my heart, and I feel, at least geographically, like it's the place I know best, apart from North Carolina, where we live, I intend to write as many books about that area as I can. So I do write a lot when I'm up there.
Do you see yourself, and Salem as well, ever moving to Vermont?
I would do it in a New York minute. Salem has her roots pretty firmly planted right here in Winston-Salem, and I think I'd probably need Kim Jong-un's help to blast her out of here.
Well, let's not encourage him, okay?
Yeah, I know, really. Like, that could actually happen.
Laura, what about you? Are you firmly planted on the East Coast?
I am, and it's interesting because I actually have been giving a lot of thought to moving further north, and one of the places I'm thinking about is Vermont, the other side of the lake in upstate New York. But I've been living in the New York metropolitan area my whole life and really very disappointed with what is going on in the area. Tax-wise, I'm not very fond of New York City anymore. It's just not the city that I grew up in and that I love. I'm ready to have a change, and fewer people is really the goal.
Let's go to small town life, because as I read Goldenrod for the second time, there were things about being in a small town that I thought, I have only had that once or twice in my life. Michelle, let me ask you, what is it about this book and small town life that either appeals to you or does not appeal to you?
Well, it's kind of the double-edged sword of, you know everybody, and so there's a lot of support there and a lot of help, especially, you know, in emergency situations, but also just in general. And then the bad thing is that you know everybody, and they know all your business, and maybe some business that you don't want them to.
And Laura, what about you?
Just such a wonderful cast of characters in this small town, and it's interesting and fascinating to me how Anne is so able to draw these characters so fully with the vernacular and the socioeconomic issues. And I don't think I've ever read a book where someone can write so beautifully about music and then about logistics. And it just is fascinating to me. And I would love to live someplace like that, because it is diverse. And as Michelle said, I mean, it is nice to have community, especially when there's an emergency. And yes, there's the flip side. Everybody knows everything, and that can be a little daunting.
Anne, what about you?
You know, I grew up in a really small town in upstate Pennsylvania, not too far from Lake Erie. You know how we're always encouraged to write what we know, and when I finally decided I wanted to try to write a book, it occurred to me that this would be a great way to do it. So I was in, you know, my parents at that time lived in a small town in Virginia that actually is the prototype for Jericho. It's a small town called Independence. And I spent tons and tons of time up there and really got to know that area and to listen and to learn and to love the way people live their lives. And I wanted to try to do something where I could make the community function like a character in the book, you know, where the town and the setting almost functioned like other parts of the story. So that's really what I tried to do, and that's why I wanted to do it. You know, it was in part to honor the great experience I had as a youngster growing up in a little community very similar to that, and also to kind of pick out the sort of best and brightest things about what it can be like to live in the South.
It struck me that, I don't know if you've any of you have seen the movie Big Eden, but the town was very supportive of the two gay central characters. In a way, obviously, there are people in this book who do not approve of the gay characters, but overall, they seem to fit very well in the community, and they're all different types. There's a doctor, there's a florist, there's a sheriff's deputy, there's a librarian, there's a cook. Anne, were you trying for kind of a utopian small town?
I think honestly, in the first book, Jericho, that was absolutely my intention. It was like I wanted to imagine the sort of world it would really be great to live in. Then, you know, as I kind of progressed in the series, I became more acquainted with that adage, neurotics build castles in the sky and psychotics live in them. So it sort of, you know, became clear to me that I maybe was straining credibility just a tad, and that it probably was about time, you know, to throw these characters some real-life curveballs. So that's what I tried to do. And it was like a balancing act to not explode everything that I think many readers love about spending a little bit of time in this community, but to kind of balance that with enough reality that it could speak to a lot of the things we all deal with every day, particularly now.
Yes. In fact, I was looking at reviews on Amazon. I was kind of startled to see, and there are quite a few reviews, 97% gave 5 stars.
And I think there's like 1 4-star review.
There's 1 4-star review.
I sent her a candygram. I hope she changes her mind.
Cheetos?
Yeah, Cheetos.
Cheetos! Now that I know there are white cheddar ones, who knew?
Yeah, I thought you knew everything. I've been disabused.
Apparently I don't. That's why I need you, Radar.
There is one reviewer, Tammy D., who said about your book, in addition to the usual quirky characters, and you do seem to specialize in those, that was me, not her, the author acknowledges an ugliness that exists in this country that used to bubble just beneath the surface, but lately is more obvious and unfortunately is becoming more prevalent in our daily lives. I don't exactly know what to do about it yet, but I do know that books like this are important. They're important not just because they make me want to become more engaged, but because they reinforce the message that no one should have to stand alone. Could you respond to that, Laura?
The prologue of the book, when I read that, I had this overwhelming fear of where the book was going to head. And it was heartbreaking also. But knowing, you know, the series, I didn't really expect this to devolve into some dark, terrifying story. And it really was fascinating the way it unfolded, and it didn't become apparent immediately what was going on, but it was also very heartwarming that so many people were paying attention and could see, and I'm really talking about Sid and Celine, and they could see what was happening, and the character wasn't alone, and it just made me feel so much more encouraged that this takes place in this book. And we all want that in our daily lives. We don't want the notion that we're alone and no one's paying attention. So I thought it was really well done, and I loved the way it unfolded.
Michelle?
I agree with what Laura said, and in particular that, and I'll say that I found from experiences that sometimes you just need one person, at least, you know, for a little while. And I think Anne has given, you know, the people in different situations, she has given them that one person that they needed to get them kind of over the hump to be able to go on.
And Anne, is that what you were trying for and succeeded in, I should say?
Well, thank you for that, all of you. I guess I knew that I was really taking a chance with what I did with the story of Dorothy, who's very dear to me. In fact, I named her for Dorothy Allison. It's probably not hard to figure out, but that mattered to me because a part of Dorothy's story is part of my own story. Some of the things are autobiographical for me, and I tend to do that in all of my books, but I probably do it a little more, stealthily perhaps, than I did in this one. I'm not saying that Dorothy is me, but I am saying that I do believe we're all products of everything. You know, we're all 100% who we are, and because I do view the characters in this community almost like aspects of one person, it mattered a lot to me to introduce some of those other elements. And I love the fact that you all felt that she was cared for and noticed, because I think that's the best thing that we can all do in our lives for the people around us.
There's a passage about Roma Jean, but it struck me it's going to be about Dorothy as well. You say, and this is Charlie, who's fallen for... And that's pretty early on. I'm not giving anything away, but she's falling for Roma Jean. And she says she was like that big milkshake blender at Dairy Queen, filled to the brim with every wonderful thing you could think of and running flat out. Shy, blunt, clumsy, confident, funny, sad, smart, clueless, sassy, scared. She was all those things, tumbled together inside the best blizzard ever made. And I realized, and that's one of the things I really appreciated about this book, those are my favorite people. My favorite people are all those things. They're confident yet vulnerable. They're sad. They're joyous. I just want to compliment you, Anne, on the complexity of many of these characters. Laura?
I agree completely, and it's, I think I said it earlier, I just love your ability to have someone who can talk about music in such an intelligent and in-depth way, and then you have Jocelyn, who is talking about moving freight around the country and balancing that so well, and all of these characters are so deeply defined. I mean, it's not, they're not just flashes on the page. They really feel that you could know someone like this, that, you know, you may be standing next to someone like this in the store. And it's just, it's always so well done.
Thank you. And the reality is, we do stand next to those people in the store, don't we? Or as I say, in line at the post office, where I seem to spend an inordinate amount of my life. you know, and if you, it's like the great writer Doris Betts said, you just pay attention, because this is who we are. This is who we all are. And I think the job of writing, at least for me, is to just get out of the way. Just get out of the way and let them talk. Let them tell their stories in their own ways.
Michelle?
One of the themes that I picked up on was sort of decision-making, the choices that people are making, and the issues that they're dealing with. So I started to list what I thought some of the different things were that each of the characters was dealing with. And I came to the same conclusion as I had when I read Backcast, that all of the major themes in life someone is dealing with, you know, in this book, whether it's sexuality, abortion.
Moving freight.
Yeah.
Moving freight, a piano across country. What to order at Denny's?
abuse or whatever. And so that's, but it's all, it all happens organically. And, you know, this was my second time reading the book preparing for the show. And the first time it didn't strike me the way it did when I started to catalog it.
I have to pay Anne a compliment, because the first time I was reading the book, I was reading it very, very closely. And so I wasn't expecting to be moved, because I was reading line by line. And there were several sections in the book that made me laugh out loud, so that my sons came in to see what I was watching on YouTube. and there was another passage that made me mist over and brought me to tears. So I have to congratulate you, Anne, because that's tough to have the laughter and the tears in one book.
Well, thank you.
I want to ask you, too, now this is a more personal question, so go ahead, feel
Let
free
me have
to that. Answer.
Hang on. I need a drink. Okay, I'm ready.
All right. So in this book, there's a great knowledge displayed about music.
Oh, okay.
And cars. Okay.
And cars.
Yeah. And gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And food. The amuse-bouche, for instance. And drink.
Mm-hmm.
And animals, especially dogs and cats.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have all of those in your interests and in your life?
Yes, I do. I don't know that I would claim any particular level of proficiency with any of them, except for the ones that involve vodka. But but I do. And I do, you know, again, it's write what you know, you know, or write what you're interested in, write what you're passionate about. And I will share with you that, honestly, when I finished this book and I submitted it to Kelly Smith at Bywater, who is absolutely the most magnificent person you could ever imagine working with as a content editor, I fully predicted, because I'm almost tempted when I turn things into her to just go ahead and highlight passages that I know she's going to tell me have to get caught. And the whole thing, that whole scene with Celine and the piano tuner,
where
they find
that,
Yeah.
Favorite.
You know, I can't even tell you. I spent a whole day of my life lost in learning about that man, Raymond Parada, who's real, who was real. I mean, he really was the tone regulator at Steinway for all those years. I mean, I learned everything about this man, everything I could find about him. And I even spent hours scouring the interwebs to actually find a photograph of him. And I finally did. So I was so sure that all of that stuff that I packed into that was just so precious to me that there was no way it would ever make it into print. She left it.
As a copy editor, I love research and I love historical fiction. And I think there are some authors who think, well, I'm making it up. But when something like Raymond Parada is so real and we're talking about details that are so real, I go look. And I thought, wow, she did a lot of research.
Did you go look him up?
Oh, absolutely.
Did you?
I read all about him.
You probably want to make sure I spelled his name right.
That too. But no.
But you know, he really did that. He found a discreet place to sign his name inside every single piano at Steinway he worked on.
And you even had the location in Manhattan where he had done his work.
Yeah, that's right.
And Laura, let me ask you this. When you read a book set in New York City, do you look for those details to be correct?
You know, it's funny because that building isn't there anymore. It was just taken down recently.
That's right.
And it's actually been very controversial because they are building a skyscraper there that's only about 30 feet wide. It's becoming financially unviable. But yes, I do always, especially talking about Steinway, and I went and looked him up too because it sounded too real. It just couldn't have been a fictional character, and I enjoy those little nuggets. I also really enjoyed the piece you put in there about the Poppin' Johnnies from John Deere.
I got that from Cheryl Fletcher.
There was a couple other little things that I just, little nods to people that I thought were really nice and well done.
I can't imagine anyone reading this book and not finding those little nods, for instance.
Oh, I just love them. And I love them when people find them. Like, I heard from Faye Jacobs, and there, you know, the scene where Maddie is ragging Sid about her car and what a piece of junk it is, you know, and Maddie makes a crack like, you know, the car probably belonged to Inger Stevens, you know, and Faye was just like dying because she's like, we are probably, you know, two of the only people on the planet who will even remember who Inger Stevens was.
And I wondered if this was a nod to Faye Jacobs as well.
It was.
When you say that Rehoboth Beach is about tanning,
yes,
drag shows, parading your candy-ass
dogs.
And it's a beach town trifecta.
What was it? Tanning brunch and parading your candy. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, there was a line that just made me laugh when you just mentioned briefly a 72 Ford Pinto, because that was my first car. It was a powder blue 72 Ford Pinto that I went all across the country in that back and forth, and it never exploded on me once.
That's hilarious. Well, like, I always put something in every book, too, that's an homage to Joni Mitchell, always. And Jocelyn Painter drives a 57 Biscayne. Remember her song Raised on Robbery?
Vaguely, yes.
Yeah, he drove a 57 Biscayne and put it in a ditch.
We're going to take a break. Please, Laura and Ann, stay on the line. We
okay.
have to do our announcement for the station, and we're going to have a brief song.
Oh, the streets are so wide, you can diagonally park in that small town, in that small town. Yeah, the streets are so wide.
This is the Sandra Moran Radio Book Club. It's a bonus show. We are talking about Anne McMahon's Goldenrod, and that song by Trett Furey, Small Town, was chosen by Linda Wilson. What did you think, Anne?
I thought it was great. A little sad.
So
well, no, it's wonderful, but all the little businesses rolling up and closing, you know.
But true.
Yeah, very true.
Let's talk some about characters. We talked some about Dorothy. I want to talk about some of the other characters in the book. Anne, you indicated that you're very fond of Dorothy. What's another character that you are particularly attached to?
Buddy. Buddy. And Buddy was the hardest one for me to write. I felt like he was really the linchpin of the book. Buddy was kind of the still point of the turning world in the story, and he had this, and I really didn't intend this, but I realized that he emerged as almost he was like a prognosticator in a way. He had this sort of clairvoyant about people's motivations and what would and wouldn't happen. And I like the fact that he was pretty much an unknown to everyone except Henry.
I know what you're saying, because Henry would miss the bus because of being kept for detention for no good reason. And Buddy knew when that was going to happen.
Buddy just knew.
This rang true to me.
The other thing that, I mean, I'd really love to take credit for it, but it was one of those wonderful gifts that sometimes happen when you're writing. When I decided to have the book that Dorothy is reading to Henry, the one they get at the bookmobile, The Incredible Journey, I picked that book intentionally, I think, for pretty obvious reasons. It's about a journey to get back home, about the three animals who travel all the way across Canada to reach their missing owner. And I wanted that to parallel Henry's journey. And I actually had a copy of the book, and I would like dip into it and pull little passages out here and there as much as I was able legally to quote. And when I got to the part where Buddy is reading the book to Henry and he's reading it backward, I went to the book and I literally, because I thought, well, okay, we're at this part in the story, so they would be about this far through the book, because I knew they were going to finish the book near the end. So I literally opened the book to the middle and just picked a passage. And when I wrote it down backward, I could not... I'm not like a woo-woo person in the slightest, but I could not, when you read that passage backward, I couldn't believe how perfectly it paralleled exactly where everything in the book was going.
I think when you are thinking that deeply and focus that much on a character, I think there has to be some woo-woo involved.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, but I loved that. I was just very, that was like one of those few moments I get, you know, where I kind of sit back and went, wow, you know, I really wrote that.
Laura, let me ask you, and then I'll turn to Michelle.
Well, yeah, Buddy was a phenomenal character, but I also really enjoyed James's journey in the book, and I thought it was really courageous what he ended up doing at the end. And, you know, it was just so heartwarming and told in such a touching way. I really liked how that was handled and how it all came together.
Michelle, before I ask you, I want to mention that we do have listeners from all over, and one is Benny Pardee in England. She says that she really enjoyed how Roma Jean was the one who took the initiative over her and Charlie's relationship. Just showed how mature she had become. She just followed her journey. So thank you for that, Benny. How about you, Michelle?
Well, I wanted to throw in one quote, because one of my favorite quotes, and this is Henry talking about Buddy's reading backwards. A story was a story no matter where it started, and sometimes waiting for the beginning to happen was better than knowing the end.
Well, boy, haven't we all been there?
I will confess that I'm one of those people, and I've met others, who read newspapers and magazine articles from the back page. I always have. And if you know, it's a jump, then I will go back and read the beginning of it, but I read from the back to the front.
What a curious thing for an editor. You know, because you kind of think, in the classical sense, the least important stuff, you know, as you read like a news story or something is you know, occurs as you go along.
But I've had people say, like proofing your own work, to read it backwards, because then you're not looking at content. You're just looking at what's there.
That's it, what Michelle said.
Sorry.
Let me ask you a question from Karen Richard, Anne. She asks, how do you keep track of all the Jericho characters? And then we'll talk about some others. But how do you do that?
Well, it's certainly not romantic, but I am a scrupulous outliner, and I have to be. And part of the reason I have to be, I mean, there's no, like, arrogance around. I think it makes me a better writer. But also, when you write books like I do that have these Cecil B. DeMille casts of characters, you know, I have to do that. You know, and I have to decide, how many stories am I going to tell? How are they going to intersect each other? And what kind of structure do I design to make sure that I move them all along at the same rate and get them to come together the way I need them to at the end? So I have, like, notebooks and pages and diagrams and, you know, things all over the place that remind me. So when I sit down to write, I know how many chapters are going to be in the book, and I usually know how many scenes in each chapter and which scene is going to be about which part of the story. And I knew in this book, for example, that every chapter in the book had to have at least one, and two was better, scenes about Maddie and Sid.
That reminds me of something. She's a self-professed super fan, so I'm not saying this about her. Tara Scott wrote a wonderful review, and she said that Goldenrod is a nice mix of familiar and new characters. Definitely accomplished that blending of the stories that are familiar and brand new. That's difficult. And how I know you said you outlined, but did you have a sense of where the book was going and the path it would take from the beginning?
Yeah, I absolutely did. I mean, I knew what I wanted. I knew where I wanted to take everybody by the end of this book. And, you know, when I originally started writing, I mean, I knew when I started writing this book that there was going to be another, at least one more Jericho book in the series. So I left that little bitty cliffhanger at the end, which, you know, even if I never wrote another one, it doesn't really change anything, because I kind of got most of the major characters to really good places. But yeah, I absolutely knew where it was going to go and exactly what note I wanted them all to end on.
Laura, what did you think about the pacing of the book?
I actually have a question, if that's okay. I was wondering how difficult or easy it was to write such a villainous character as Gerald Watson.
Oh, yeah. I worried a lot about Gerald Watson, and I'll tell you why. It wasn't hard at all, but I think that's what made me worry about him, because I realized that what I was doing with him was I was pretty much, it's like the Bible says about, boy, is this a weird example, but it's like the Bible says about Jesus, the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. I kind of wanted to do that with Watson. I wanted him to be a lightning rod for all of these things, you know, that are kind of coming at us now. And I worried a little, as I said, about doing that, that, you know, you're like, can you really, is it credible to have one person who can be so imbued with all of these contemptible qualities? So I needed him to be that person, but at the same time, I worried that I was almost making him a little too burlesque.
Since it first came out, how it's become more and more on target.
One of the things that I really liked about the book was you brought in some characters, but didn't spend a lot of time on them. I would have loved more, for instance, about Azalea.
Azalea.
Okay. Sorry.
Isn't she great?
She is. Sitting there in her Nikes.
I know, eating her chicken legs.
Did you consider doing more about her?
Well, Azalea is kind of like this sort of little crazy woman who's an expert at Grand Theft Auto. And I just kind of like having her out there on the periphery, like in Aftermath. She's got the same kind of role. You know, she ends up out at that revival where Roma Jean knocks the evangelist box of snakes over, and Azalea pulls out her pistol and caps one of them. I just kind of like, she actually reminds me of my grandmother.
And to kind of follow on, Azalea is Aunt Evelyn.
Aunt Evelyn
tells Charlie to, she better go listen to Azalea when, you know, in the end scene there when they're all at the 4th of July picnic.
Because, you know, Azalea hates Yankees.
Yes. So I love the way Roma Jean kind of guides things so that she doesn't blow the greatest opportunity she has to impress Azalea.
I like Azalea. I think she's just a wing nut. And I like thinking that you've got, like, you know, Maddie is kind of like the ultimate straight man in a comedy act. And she's sort of like rooted right there in the middle of all of this like nutso stuff that's constantly swirling around her. Now, one of the things that meant a lot to me with this book was I felt like in the first two books, I mean, I think I did a little better with her in Aftermath, but I really wanted to give Maddie's mother a life and a fully developed personality. And that mattered to me to do that. And I loved writing about Celine. I just loved it. I loved creating a life for her, you know, her house and her music and her budding relationship with this younger man. I loved that.
And I love the music through it. Of course, I believe in the interconnectedness of the arts, so, you know, I love the way you do that, like what you did in Backcast with visual art. To me, you did that with music in this book. And to me, the piano actually became a character. Because there were so many important relationships of different characters with the piano.
Well, I'd love in like a future life or something, I mean, I'd love to write more about Celine's childhood with her parents.
Who
were both career musicians, and the whole connection with her grandparents in Austria and the Nazis and all that.
And Laura, I know you've been studying ancestry and genealogy. What did you think about the interconnectedness of the characters and the generations?
You know, I thought it was really interesting from the first book how the change in Celine's personality and how tender she was, but she was the person who was also aware of Buddy's ability and what he was all about, and Dorothy, and she really was the compassionate and loving mother figure that she was not at all in the first
book.
I thought
Maddie.
It was a really interesting and nice transformation. I mean, you really saw her in a different light. I would love if you ever sat down and wrote about her childhood, because I think it would be fascinating. I can't even imagine what it would be like growing up in a house with that much talent and intellect. You could probably go on forever.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, Anne, you said you were thinking about a book about Celine. Have you ever considered, you kind of have your own genre, you know? It's
really?
Yeah.
Hey.
There's path.
Do we get to call it something?
Yeah, I think it's quirky.
Can we invent a new BSAC code for it? You know, something we can use as...
Absolutely. I mean, you are AMFA, so...
Well, that is true.
And for those that don't know, Anne McMahon, famous author. But if you didn't write in your own quirky genre, is there another genre you would ever want to tackle? For instance, memoir or thriller?
Oh, yes. Biography. I would love it. I majored in history in college and fully intended. I mean, that was totally the road not taken. You know, I was all set to go to grad school, and I was going to get a PhD and teach. That's what I really wanted to do. I ended up going in a radically different direction and have worked instead as a career graphic designer. But I have always been fascinated with biography, and I love to read biographies of really unknown people. In fact, I did a little homage to that when Jocelyn is in the library at the book sale.
Oh, right.
Yes. You know,
right,
buying, you know, like she only buys books by dead people. and then she likes biographies of people who are, like, not famous.
Not famous and gets a discount.
Gets a discount. Right. But I would love that. I have always wanted to write a biography of the Cohn sisters, Clara Bell and Etta Cohn, the daughters of the great textile magnate, who were great friends of Gertrude Stein's and were outrageous. And they traveled the world, and they, because of Gertrude Stein, they amassed this amazing collection of Impressionist art. And they left the collection, it's called the Cohn Collection, to the Baltimore Museum. And it's one of the largest private collections of Impressionist art in the world. And these women were just fantastic characters. You know, they would go to the opera, and they would always get four seats, two for them and two for their purchases.
That's wonderful. Laura, what about you?
I was just going to, when you were talking about the book sale, I think I told you this, Elizabeth. Did you know that Robert B. Parker was dead?
Yes. Oh, my word. I'm so mortified.
I was, too.
Well, why didn't we fix it?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to mortify you.
I'm going to have to address that in the next book. I think Jocelyn's going to have to return it.
Oh, yeah, I think she should, you know, get a discounter.
Yeah, she'll say, hey, you know what? You told me he was still alive, and he ain't.
Well, you know what? People that drive around in a bookmobile can't know everything.
Boy, is that the truth. And you know, I did that. That was my first job out of college. I drove a bookmobile.
I have to admit, I worked in four libraries.
And it's the best work in the world.
It is, unless you have a crazy librarian that you're working for.
Well, they're all crazy. But the bookmobile, oh my word, You know, I think of that as the salad days. You know, I would go in there and load up that truck in the morning, and, man, I was working a rural part of North Carolina, and there was nothing. There was nothing but dirt roads and chicken farms.
I bet you pasted some book pockets, too.
I sure did.
I did that. Well,
I used to have to carry. I had a 16 millimeter film projector, and I would like take movies and stuff like that, you know, and show them at the stops. And I would have to talk to these kids, like these little 13 and 14 year old girls who were showing up with their children, wanting to talk about contraception.
So that sounds familiar from a job I had in rural Missouri. Very familiar. Let me ask you, since we got on the subject of bookmobiles, one last thought about the book. And also, why reading a book like this is significant and why it is delightful, but it's also significant. Laura?
This book, especially with the release coming when it did, the commentary, the political commentary, obviously wasn't the main focus of the book, but just that whole feeling that was sliding backwards, I just thought it was so timely and frightening, because never in my life did I think this would happen again, and we seem to be going backwards instead of forwards. But at the same time, when you roll that into a community like this and you see how important it is to stick together and to have a voice.
I also appreciated the nod to climate change. It's never directly mentioned, but why are the fireflies out at this time? And mention of in the garden, oh my gosh, this is blooming. And I thought you handled that beautifully. How about you, Michelle?
Again, kind of going to the back to the theme of the choices that you have to make, decision making. All of these characters were dealing with something on various levels. So if you can see that, you realize, you know, how much more similar we are than different, even though we're dealing with different things. And that's just such an important thing for us to take note of right now.
And Anne, even though you're the author, I'll address the question to you too.
Oh, wow. I don't think I'm equipped to answer it. Although I will say I'm really gratified that you mentioned the attention to everything happening too soon. I mean, if you asked me, I would say that's really kind of the overarching theme of the book, that in the lives, in the world we live in now, in the lives we live, that's the way it is. Everything happens too fast.
I would agree, and social media certainly does play a part in that.
Yeah, sure does.
It was nice to read a book where life was happening outside of Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, so if you all wonder where I've been.
I really, really appreciate all of you being on the panel. And Anne, thank you so much for giving up your time.
Oh, my goodness, no. Thank you all. I wish I could hang out with you guys all the time. This has been delightful for me. Thank you.
And I want to mention, Anne, you were on the very first Santa Moran Radio Book Club that we did.
I sure was.
With Marianne K. Martin and Cheryl Pletcher, and we talked about...
Hot Lips.
And we talked about the... And Butch, right?
And Butch. Hot Lips and Butch.
And we talked about the price of salt, and then you were on last year for Backcast, and this year for Goldenrod. So what's your plan for next year?
Hey, I'm writing a book. Thanks. Do I get to plug it? Yay.
Right ahead.
I'm writing a book right now called, you're going to love this, I hope, Beowulf for Cretans, A Love Story. And it's about a 40-something college English professor who is in the final year of a tenure track position, and she teaches at a small private college in Vermont, and her world is thrown into chaos when she ends up having an affair with the new female president of the college.
Uh-oh. That sounds like a romance gone wrong.
Mm-hmm. Or right.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing what Grendel is like in that book.
Grendel. Yeah, Grendel is the 9 o'clock dog.
We're out of time, so again, thank you, and let's carry any discussion on Facebook. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Michelle. And thank you, Anne.
And thank you all.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.